So my name is Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here. Welcome everybody, especially everyone on Zoom. Welcome to you as well. Thanks so much for joining us. Today is actually the first Sunday for a long time where masks are optional. So a bit of a landmark for us. Now, with that in mind, yeah. So for some people, that's fantastic. For others, it's not, you know, it's a little bit nerve-wracking. So let's just continue to be respectful of one another in terms of space and closeness and that kind of thing. But I think it's a sign that we're heading in the right direction, which is really encouraging. So let's just bear one another in mind. Also, just to note, just so you know, we're going to be continuing with our Zoom services on Zoom. So if you're more comfortable participating that way, that will continue as well. We've been through 3 years of challenges, you know, with the pandemic and everything. And just want to say thank you. So that we had our 3 year anniversary last Monday of when we first closed the church down or closed the buildings down. I just want to say thank you to everybody for rallying and supporting and being so faithful and loving throughout this time. One of the, I think the highlights for us within all that has just been the way we've rallied around volunteering and giving sacrificially through times that for many, many churches were really, really difficult. So just again, want to thank you. Speaking of giving, if you look on the back page of the bulletin that you would have got, the flyer, when you came in today, you'll see that we've had some good weeks and we've had some lean weeks. And our year-to-date goal is just dipping a little bit. So I just want to encourage everybody to continue to give generously and faithfully. Again, thank you for all that's been done already. But, you know, our community is run financially by the donations of people like you and me. And so let's just maintain that faithfully as we head into the spring months. We're in a series, as Melinda mentioned earlier, called Heart Cries from the Cross, where we're looking at the seven sayings of Jesus recorded in the Gospels from the cross. And they're agonizing, very often, heart cries. And the one that we're going to look today in particular is that's the case for this one. It's the famous saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's perhaps the most agonizing. I mean, if you compare it to other ones we've looked at, like Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing, or today you'll be with me in paradise. Those have, they're agonizing, but they have some sort of positive connotation to them, perhaps more obviously. Whereas my God, why have you forsaken me? It feels bleak, it has this sense of anguish, and obviously of abandonment. We're going to explore that a little bit today. It's perhaps the darkest saying. It's also unique in many respects, including for the fact that it's the only saying that appears in the Gospels of Mark and Matthew. The Gospel of Luke has three of the sayings. The Gospel of John has three of the sayings. But this saying only appears in Matthew and Mark. So it's the only one in those Gospels, which I think is significant. Because when you think about it, if, as most scholars would suggest, Mark was the first Gospel written, and then Matthew and Luke had that text when the authors wrote them. And if you compare the three Gospel accounts, Mark's with Matthew and Luke, Matthew and Luke clearly track very closely with Mark, just the sequencing of everything. But it's interesting that Luke chooses to drop this saying and has three other sayings. Father, forgive them. Today you'll be with me in paradise. And then right at the end, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Those are three very different sayings. So Luke is telling a different side of the story to the story that's being told in Mark and Matthew. In Mark's gospel, and that's where we're going to look at this passage today, this saying and the context of the passage it comes in. If you think about it, this is the only thing, if we just read Mark's gospel, this is the only thing Jesus says from the cross. So it's particularly anguishing. It's also unique in that, as I mentioned before, that it's the only one that appears in two gospels. Okay, so all the other sayings of Jesus only appear in one gospel, three in Luke, three in John. So there's something unique about this saying in many respects. What I want to do this morning is just talk a little bit about the context for this saying, particularly as it appears in the Gospel of Mark. So we'll sort of look at some of the context and try to draw out with that context this saying, give it a little bit of life, give it a little bit of breathing space, if you like, so that it might sort of as we reflect on it and meditate on it, which we'll do towards the end of this message, there might be some life to it that perhaps we haven't experienced before or seen before. So we'll just sort of do a little bit of context, but then we're going to actually look at the saying and meditate on the saying. The saying appears towards the end of chapter 15 of Mark. There's only 16 chapters in Mark. 16 deals with the resurrection. 15, going in reverse order, deals with the trial of Jesus and his eventual crucifixion. And in Mark 14, the chapter before, we get the beginning of the end, if you like, where it's Jesus is anointed by a woman with perfume, expensive perfume, and it's the last straw for Judas. And it says that he decides that he's going to betray Jesus. Judas is angry because he feels like it's a waste of money. And there's all sorts of implications about why that might be. Maybe Judas was very politically inclined and wanted Jesus to bring some kind of political revolution. Maybe John's gospel says he looked after the money, so he wanted as much money to go into that bag because he was stealing from it. We don't really know exactly what the case is, but certainly this is a turning point for Judas. And right before that, at the end of chapter 13, it says the religious authorities are so mad at Jesus that they're plotting to kill him. And then immediately we get Judas is ready to betray Jesus. And Jesus says, when this woman anoints him with oil, that she's done it to prepare me for my burial. So there's this sense of foreboding cast over the whole of the next few chapters, which is, okay, so they said they're going to kill Jesus. And Jesus is saying, I'm being prepared for burial. In other words, it looks like that plot to kill him is going to be successful. So that's the sort of the air, the atmosphere that the author of Mark creates as we read through these subsequent chapters. As I mentioned, really, Mark's story is pretty much followed by Matthew, especially, and to a large degree, Luke. There's some variations along the way, but there's several unique aspects to what Mark says, things that the Gospel of Mark says that aren't included in Matthew and Luke. I think those are kind of interesting, too. I'll just pick out one of them, and that's when Jesus is arrested and everybody flees. One person, it says in Mark, flees, and somebody grabbed onto their coat, onto their cloak, and pulled it off, and they fled naked. And there's been all sorts of speculation about what this means. Does it refer to a passage in Amos? Does it refer to a passage in the Psalms? What's the significance of it? Was it somebody who was ready to be baptized, that night, but that didn't work out? I think probably what we're seeing there, and this is part of the style of Mark, the author of Mark's storytelling style, is to give us a metaphorical look into what's really going on in this story, which is exposure. The disciples flee. It's like they're naked. They gave up everything to follow Jesus. Now they're giving up everything to get away from Jesus. And we're sort of seeing them for who they really are. And we're also seeing Jesus for who he really is, as we're going to see as we unpack this a little bit. So then we get to chapter... So Jesus has been arrested. He gets tried. He's eventually condemned to death. We read a little bit more about that in Luke's account, where he goes to Pilate and he goes to the Sanhedrin and then to Pilate. And in Luke's account, he goes to Herod as well. In the end, he's condemned to death. And we're going to read now in chapter 15, the crucifixion story. And I'm going to read it. I mean, it'll appear on the screens as well. Let's just try and soak this up. Obviously, we've heard these stories so many times. Let's try and soak them up as though we're hearing it for the first time, and kind of feel it. Feel the emotion that's written into this story. They brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. Then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him. Dividing up his clothes, they cast lots to see what each would get. It was 9 in the morning when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." They crucified two rebels with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down off the cross and save yourself." In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down from the cross now, that we may see and believe. Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. At noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. And at 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing near heard this, they said, "Listen, he's calling for Elijah." Someone ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, and put it on a staff and offered it to Jesus to drink. "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down," he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion, who stood there in front of Jesus, saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Okay, so there's the story of Jesus's crucifixion. It's a horrendous story of an innocent person being convicted and executed. And what we have there, and I just want to unpack this a little bit, is just really, I think, brilliant storytelling. The way this story is told has so much import and context. And as I said at the beginning, if we can draw some of that out, I think it puts a weightier meaning to this saying, my God, why have you forsaken me?" First of all, I didn't really notice that there's a sort of a time mark, you know, at the third hour, at the sixth hour, and that's translated in modern translations as at 9 o'clock, and at noon, at 3 o'clock. There's this sort of, there's the ebb and flow of the story, but then it's marked out like a clock striking. And it's almost like inevitability, if you like, the inevitability of Jesus's death. What we have, maybe we could put that next slide up. I'm just going to sort of look at a few aspects to this storytelling, a few aspects to this context. The first one is darkness and foreboding. So I said at the beginning, you know, we have this sense of, a plot to kill Jesus. Jesus is saying, "I've been anointed for my burial." And in this story itself that we just read, we have darkness. There's the Golgotha, the place of the skull. We don't know exactly where that is. We don't know why this place is called the place of the skull. It may have looked like a skull. Maybe it was a hill shaped like a skull. Or maybe it's a place of execution. But it has a dark connotation to it. And we hear that darkness comes over the land. Right? Darkness. Now, some people have contemplated whether that was a solar eclipse. Well, it's the time of the Passover, which is a time of full moon. So it couldn't be a solar eclipse. So it's some kind of other darkness, perhaps. Matthew kind of adds to this darkness by saying that there was an earthquake, and that's what tore the curtain in the temple in two. And also it ruptured various graves, and people, dead people came out and started walking around. I mean, I think what we have here is a very apocalyptic sense, right? It's a sense of darkness and the cosmos in disarray and the cosmos in disorder. All that adds to this sense of darkness and foreboding in Mark's storytelling. We also have here clear bookending with the baptism story. Let's look at that baptism story. So that appears in the first chapter of Mark. Mark doesn't really mess around, but he just jumps right into the action with Jesus's life. And you may notice as we read it, some similarities. We'll draw those out afterwards and what the significance might be. At that time, Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. Just as Jesus was coming up out of the water, he saw heaven being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, "You are my Son, whom I love. With you, I am well pleased." Okay, so what we have here, I think, is some similarities to the passage that we just read. If maybe we can just pop that one up again, Amanda. If on this one we have the heavens being torn, and that word schizo is the word for torn there in the Greek. The heavens are torn open. The spirit pneuma descends, is pneuma in the Greek for spirit. And then there's a sort of affirming voice. The Father affirms the Son. In the story that we just read about the crucifixion, we have the exact opposite in the opposite sequence, right? We have, rather than affirmation of the son by the farmer, there's this anguish experienced by the son of, my God, why have you forsaken me? There's the giving up of the ghost, or the giving up of the spirit, or the giving up of breath. Pneuma, again, it's the same word. And in ancient cultures, as we said many times, spirit and breath are used interchangeably. They're the same word. And as a result of that, the temple is torn in two. Again, schizo in the Greek, and that's the only two times the author of Mark ever uses that those two words. Schizo, rend the heavens apart, tear the heavens apart in the baptism, and tear the curtain, the temple curtain, in two in the crucifixion scene. So we have these sort of comparisons. Now some of that's probably a literary technique of sorts, but I think also perhaps the author is alluding to some things here. So for instance, this is Jesus living a sacrificial life. So he breathes in the spirit and he breathes out the spirit. He takes up life and he surrenders life willingly, because he's doing it for love. It's because he refuses to retaliate. He refuses to return violence with violence, refuses to return fear with fear, is only willing to love. And I think what we have also here is an allusion to that non-violence. So for instance, this term, the rending of the heavens, the tearing of the heavens, was not an unusual term in Jewish culture, or certainly in Hebrew scriptural culture, let's call it that. If we look at Isaiah 64, oh, that you would rend the heavens and come down, that the mountains would tremble before you, as when fire sets twigs ablaze and causes water to boil. Come down to make your name known to your enemies and cause the nations to quake before you. Now, I don't think that this is necessarily alluded to in Isaiah, but you have this sense of come down, so rend the heavens, and it's kind of kick butt and take names, right? It's prove yourself. Come on, God, come down and prove yourself and defeat your enemies and show yourself as powerful. And this sort of, and certainly if you read the rest of that chapter, there's some violent connotations to that chapter about how God's going to judge and vindicate God's self and prove God's self. And it's a little bit like what they're saying to Jesus on the cross, right? Prove yourself. If you're so powerful, if you're really the Messiah, if you're really the Son of God, prove it. Because you are not proving it right now. You're just being strung up there and nailed up there and you're dying. And that proves that you are not the Son of God. In contrast, the Roman centurion, who is probably a war-torn, you think about that centurion. That centurion has been executing power based on the human concept of power. Goodness knows where in the world. I mean, the Roman Empire is expanding. Here is that centurion leading a force of soldiers that are there to keep people in subjugation. And even he says, surely this is the Son of God. So at the baptism, we have a divine voice. This is my beloved son. In the crucifixion, we have people saying, you are not God's son. But a centurion says, this is God's beloved son, effectively. Surely this was the Son of God. And he says it because of the way Jesus dies. And I wonder, and I might be reading a little bit into this, but I wonder if it's the non-violence. He sees the love there, because this is not about vindication. This is not about retaliation. This is about the heavens being opened, going back to the baptism story. And rather than come down from your holy mountain, and this is a motif in Isaiah's, a common motif in Hebrew scripture called the march of the divine warrior. Come down from your holy mountain, God, and smite your enemies. In Mark's gospel at the beginning, the heavens are opened, and you can imagine the Hebrew readers wondering what's going to happen, and the spirit descends like a dove, a symbol of peace, a symbol of nonviolence. That's what Jesus is taking on. And that's the same reason that Jesus was able to let it go. And I think of that term, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. It's taken from the first chapter of Job. I find that a very uncomfortable saying because it almost sounds glib. It's like God's a capricious, you know, well, I'll give you this, but then you can, I'm going to take that away. And it feels random and judgmental, etc. But what if we saw that through the light of a willingness to embrace life, to live it sacrificially, and even to be willing to let go of it and to hold our lives perhaps lightly, the things we have, the people we have, to treasure them, but to hold them lightly for the sake of something much bigger, much more beautiful, much more wonderful, which is, I think, what Jesus is doing here. So there's this book ending that's going on in Mark's gospel that I think tells us something about what's going on in the crucifixion scene. Another sort of aspect of the storytelling of Mark here is the use of Aramaic. So this is another unique thing about this particular saying from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's the only saying from the cross that's quoted in Jesus's mother tongue, Aramaic. And, if you think about it, that's pretty special because, I don't know, some of us may have Bibles where the words of Jesus are highlighted in red, right? Words spoken by Jesus. And I think that probably tends to make us think, okay, that they're more important because Jesus said them. And that's where they're highlighted to stand out. But when you think about it, we don't really have, we have barely any of the words that Jesus actually said. What we have is people's remembrance of what Jesus said, probably passed on in, spoken in Aramaic and probably passed on in Aramaic. Then they're written down in the Gospels in Greek. And then they're translated into various languages in more recent times, including English in our Bibles. So, it's not like there was a recording of the things that Jesus said. This is verbatim. This is perhaps as verbatim as you get in these records, where somebody has remembered what Jesus said in the Aramaic. My God, why have you forsaken me? Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani in the Aramaic. And Mark uses Aramaic quite a lot throughout his gospel, or their gospel, I should say. We shouldn't assume it's written by a male, though it probably was given the context of that day. Let's just look at some of the uses of Aramaic. Golgotha is Aramaic, and he translates that, right? So Mark, the author of Mark, says it means the place of the skull. Abba is used in the Garden of Gethsemane, meaning it's an Aramaic word for father. We'll look at that one in a second. And then the saying, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, is an Aramaic saying, and it's translated for us. So each time, pretty much, the author translates it for us as well. It's transliterated in the Greek, and we read that now in the English. As I said, we're going to look at Abba and the actual statement in a second. So let's move on to the next slide. There's this issue of the metaphor of drinking the cup. And it's present in this crucifixion scene, I think. It's alluded to, and it's relevant to this saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? The metaphor of drinking the cup. Do you remember that when Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane, he prays? We looked at this in Luke's account a few weeks ago. He prays, let this cup pass from me. I don't want to drink this cup. And that's this metaphor of drinking the cup, which is a metaphor for being in a particular situation, maybe sharing in somebody's fate. It's usually associated with suffering. Drinking the cup is participating in suffering. It has connotations of drinking in God's wrath. I mean, in the way this metaphor worked in the Hebrew scriptures and what we call the Old Testament, it very often was God's anger. And again, some people would say Jesus is drinking the cup because God is angry at Jesus instead of at us. Well, we could, I think, interpret it just as easily as this is the wrath of humanity. Jesus is drinking in the darkness of humanity in going to the cross. Now let's look at this passage though. So in the Garden of Gethsemane, it appears just in the chapter before the one we just read. It says they went to a place called Gethsemane. Just pause there for a second. That's another Aramaic word, actually. It means olive press. And this is we're going to the Mount of Olives here. This is the Mount of Olives. Jesus crosses the Kidron Valley, goes to the Mount of Olives with his followers, as he often did, And there's this connotation of he's going to be crushed. The Mount of Olives is also a traditional Jewish graveyard. It's where a burial site. So it's like Jesus going to a graveyard. It's has, again, darkness and foreboding all associated with it. And he said to his disciples, sit here while I pray. He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death, he said to them. Stay here and keep watch. Going a little further, he fell to the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from him. Abba, then it's translated for us. Father, he said, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. And he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. Simon, he said to Peter, are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Once more, he went away and prayed the same thing. Then he came back. When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. They did not know what to say to him. Returning the third time, he said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? Enough. The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer. And then we have the sequence where Jesus is finally arrested. So what we have here again is a tragic scene. Jesus seems to know what's going to happen. And he's in this Gethsemane with all the symbolism of that. And he's struggling, he's wrestling. And it seems to be foreshadowing of what's going to happen with the crucifixion, because and foreshadowing of this saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? Because he separates himself off. He goes out with his disciples to the Mount of Olives, to Gethsemane. He then goes on with Peter, James, and John, and then he goes on alone. So there's like 3 degrees of separation. And then, as we see explicitly in the text, he keeps coming back to Peter, James, and John, to the disciples. And there's 3 degrees of being let down, of being kind of deserted. They've fallen asleep. They're not really there with him. They're not supportive in the way that he really needs. There's this beginning of this sense of abandonment that we see then played out in how he's treated by the religious authorities, how he's treated by the political authorities. And Jesus is progressively abandoned. Now this story in Gethsemane foreshadows the crucifixion, which comes just, you know, in the next chapter. But it also looks back really to another story that's told about Jesus with his followers, and in particular, 2 of his followers, regarding drinking the cup. Let's look at that passage briefly here. So this is a few chapters before. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. What do you want me to do for you? He asked. They replied, let one of us sit at your right hand and the other at your left in your glory. You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said. Can you drink the cup I drink, or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptizing with, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared. When the 10 heard about this, that's the other disciples, they became indignant with James and John. Now, you get the impression that they probably weren't indignant because, oh my gosh, you're so proud. And that's sacrilege. You know, that's you're contravening the values that we have as a community here. They're mad because it's like they were trying to get their foot in the door to get sort of prime position in this kingdom when Jesus takes over. Jesus called them together, and Jesus realizes that. So he responds this way. He says, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be the first must be a slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So Jesus here is talking about his death. This passage itself is excruciating because it comes on the back of Jesus teaching about the first shall be last and the last shall be first. It comes on the back of him teaching about accept the kingdom like a little child. It comes on the back of him talking about the fact for the third time he tells them he's going to die. And their instinct is, when you come into your glory, can I sit on the left? Can I sit on the right? And Jesus knows, it seems, that this, he has a cup to drink. That cup of faithfulness, that cup of servanthood means sacrifice, because absolute love inevitably means sacrifice. It's going to inevitably mean loss. And he says he's willing to drink the cup. Now, there's allusions again, jumping forward, I think, here to the crucifixion scene, and even to this expression, my God, why have you forsaken me, in these two stories. Let's look at let me look at the next slide here. In chapter 14, so when Jesus is in Gethsemane, he says, Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. So we have this sense of Jesus here, knowing about drinking the cup and then pleading with his Father, I don't want to drink it. I don't want to go down this pathway. But then surrendering and saying, I'll do what you want. Now, we could interpret that as, okay, you've got this plan. I don't understand it, but I'll just do it because, you know, it's you're in charge. To me, it's more intimate that it's Abba. So the word Abba is in the Aramaic, in Jesus' mother tongue is a tender. I mean, some people have interpreted it daddy. I think that's probably not the best translation, to be honest, but it's got this intimate, colloquial, tender sense to it. And he's saying, Abba, I surrender to your will. I think what Jesus is saying here is, your way is the right way. The way of love is the right way. I surrender to that. I'll be obedient. I'll be faithful. I'll be true. Rather than him just accepting some impending doom and fate because God has a plan. It's something more intimate, something more real than that when he says this. And so this is in contrast in many respects to his anguished cry. My God, my God. He doesn't use the term Abba there. He doesn't use the term Father. He just, my God, why have you forsaken me? There's a contrast, and we're going to explore that contrast shortly. We'll get there. So let's look at another one looking further ahead. This is in the crucifixion scene we just read. Then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. I think this is an allusion. The author of Mark is reminding us Jesus is drinking the cup. They offer him wine and myrrh. That was what the Romans did before crucifixion. Some think it was sort of a way to provide a little bit of anesthetic to the pain of crucifixion. But that's what they would offer. There's also allusions, I think, here to they're offering him, they're like his royal cupbearers. There's so many, you know, they put him in a robe and they put a crown of thorns on. It's mockery, really. And it could be that Jesus is refusing this wine and myrrh because he's just sort of not responding to the mockery. Or it could be that Jesus is making the point, or the author of Mark is making the point about Jesus, that Jesus is not drinking that cup. There's another cup being drunk here. This is the cup of suffering. This is the cup of sacrifice. This is the cup of love. And Jesus is going to drink it to the dregs, even to the point of a sense of abandonment by divine love. Jesus is going to go the whole way. We have another allusion looking ahead into Mark 15. They crucified two rebels with him, one on the right and one on the left. That sounds familiar, right? Jesus, when you come into glory, can we sit one at the right and one at the left? And so we have these two criminals there, and it's very clear the language is one on the right and one on the left, reminding us that Jesus is drinking the cup, reminding us that actually Jesus is talking about a different kind of baptism, a baptism of love that means suffering, that means nonviolence, that means it's not going to look the way you think. It's not going to look all powerful. It's going to mean people will mock you because, you know, you're not coming down off the cross. You're not proving yourself. Now let's look at the last, because this takes us into the saying. The author of Mark uses Hebrew scripture a lot, and you know all the gospel writers do. You know, you read where it says Jesus did this to fulfill Isaiah or to fulfill what it says in the Psalms or whatever. And you know, it's difficult to tell sometimes, is it? Is Jesus going around doing things that look like stories in scripture in order to make a point? Is the author just describing it that way? Or is Jesus actually, you know, were these passages in the Hebrew scriptures actually foretelling the future that Jesus was just going to live out? There's probably a bit of all three. I, you know, and I don't think we should worry too much about it, but it's interesting in the Gospels, the way the writers use the Hebrew scriptures, and particularly in Mark, I think, you know, especially so. And that is exactly the case with this expression, my God, why have you forsaken me? That is a quote, a direct quote from the first line of Psalm 22, the psalm we heard right at the beginning of the service. So Jesus, in the way this is portrayed to us, is quoting a psalm. And in fact, that psalm has many allusions to this crucifixion story. Or look at it another way, the crucifixion story has many allusions to Psalm 22. Let's look at a few of those. The first couple of verses, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from my cries of anguish? My God, I cry out day by night, but you do not answer. By night, but I find no rest. Many of us, including me, can probably relate to that, a sense of where is God? At certain times in life, and perhaps more often than we'd like to admit, a sense of abandonment, a sense of, I don't even know if God's there. This is a psalm that cries out like this. And Jesus quotes that psalm when he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? But it doesn't stop there. I'm just going to share a couple more allusions here. And I'd, you know, grab the discussion questions for this week, hard copy outside, you can download it online, because it encourages you to read the whole psalm and kind of look at the comparison with the crucifixion story. Here's another one. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. I mean, that's the author of Mark uses that term. He trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him since he delights in him. And then thirdly, we have this example. I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart has turned to wax. It has melted within me. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircle me. They pierce my hands and my feet. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment. Don't really need to explain the connections to the crucifixion story that we read a few minutes ago, right? So this is, Jesus is quoting a psalm. And at least Mark is telling us something about this psalm, or alluding to this psalm. And as we look now at that saying, as we look at this saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? Let's reflect on five possible interpretations of this. Okay, given all that context we've got, that hopefully sort of buoy it up a little bit and give us a little bit of breathing space with it, what are five possible ways of interpreting this? And then we'll reflect on a statement that tries to capture each one of those. Let's look at the first interpretations here. Maybe we can go on to that next slide. Jesus was abandoned by God, or God has abandoned Jesus. Okay, so one interpretation is that actually God abandons Jesus in this moment. That's why Jesus is crying out. That's a held belief and part of the theology of substitutionary atonement, which is that, you know, all the sin of humanity was placed on Jesus. So Jesus is the sacrifice. That means God can forgive everybody else. And so because of all that sin on Jesus, God has to abandon Jesus because God can't look at that sin. So there's a separation. I don't personally share that view. And there's also lots of tension within that because, and admitted by the people who would hold that view, the tension is, you know, it's if God is one and we have a Trinitarian view of God, how could the Father abandon the Son? How could the first person of the Trinity be separate from the second person of the Trinity? There's some theological issues that raises. But that's one view that God has abandoned Jesus. Another interpretation would be that Jesus feels abandoned. So Jesus isn't necessarily actually abandoned, but as we've seen in these stories, Jesus is in a place of total abandonment. His friends have abandoned him. He's been convicted falsely. I mean, humanity has abandoned him. Humanity has let him down. The systems of humanity have let him down. And the closest friends have let him down. Jesus is in a state of abandonment and feels like the human condition of hatred and and all the fear that's thrown at him, the isolation that he feels. And in that moment, he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Another way of looking at this would be that Jesus actually quotes this psalm, or the author quotes the psalm, because they're clarifying something for the onlookers, which could be, look, I look like I'm defeated. I look like I've failed. I look like this is all going to nothing. And you're hurling insults at me and saying, come down from the cross and prove yourself. But actually, this is love. This is love winning. And he has breath enough. Think about how traumatized his body at this point is. He has breath enough to just quote the first line of a psalm. A psalm, if we read it, actually has a lot more to it than just, my God, why have you abandoned me? Let's look at a couple of other verses from it. All the ends of the earth will remember and return to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him. Goes on to say, next slide. The suspense is killing you, I know. 31, I think it is, Psalm 22, 31. Yeah, they will proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it. So there's actually hope and resolution in this psalm. And I wonder if perhaps Mark, the author of Mark, is making this point, or Jesus is making this point, that this is a psalm of David. If we read it in the Hebrew Bible, it's a psalm of David. David, who was associated with the coming Messiah, David, who was viewed as a powerful king, but all, who was also suffered and was oppressed. And that's the context in which David writes this psalm, according to that tradition. And Jesus is saying, it's not what you think. Jesus is appealing to the crowd. Or let's go back to that slide. Jesus might be appealing to the not just to the onlookers, but the religious leaders, and particularly in challenging the religious leaders. So let's look at a verse from the Psalm 22 that I think alludes to this. I will declare your name to my people. In the assembly, I will praise you. So in the religious establishment, you who fear the Lord, praise him. You, all you descendants of Jacob, that's the people of Israel, honor him, revere him, all you descendants of Israel. Goes on, for he has not despised or scorned the suffering of the afflicted one. He has not hidden his face from him, but has listened to his cry for help. So in other words, Jesus might be saying here, look, you of all people, you should be understand what this psalm means. And you should understand the way of God being love and sacrifice and surrender, as opposed to coming down and vindicating yourself. It could be a challenge to the religious authorities. And then finally, it might be a mistranslation of the Aramaic. Just thought I'd throw that one in there as a little bit of a... So this is one of those ones, you know, difficult Bible verses where different manuscripts have different pieces, different language. And you think, like, could there be typos in the Bible? Well, there probably are some typos in the Bible. This, I don't think, is necessarily a typo, but it might be a misinterpretation. This is a very controversial view, okay, very controversial view. But some Aramaic scholars, and Aramaic is not spoken today. Well, a version of it is spoken amongst the Assyrian people in the Turkey, Syria, Iran, Iraq area. But it's a very unusual language, a very mysterious kind of language, and certainly the language that Jesus spoke at the time, it's very different to that. But if we look at the statement, maybe we can put these. So there are some scholars who would say Shabbat Thani, which is what is in the Gospels, actually means kept, destined, or born for. If Jesus wanted to say abandoned or forsaken, he would have used the term Nashatani. Now, there's different scholars have different views on this, but I'm putting it out there as, you know, the Aramaic translation. There's a chance that that may have been misinterpreted. And Jesus is not actually saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? Not actually necessarily quoting the first verse of Psalm 22. Some would say Jesus is saying, my God, for this I am destined. For this I have been set apart. This is why I took up your spirit. And now I gladly release it, because I am destined for love. I'm destined for sacrifice. That's the life I choose to live. And it takes on a very different kind of connotation. Now, what we're going to do just to sort of close out here is a meditation. So there's five possible interpretations. They're probably all wrong, and they're probably all a little bit right, okay? And there's about 250 other ones that we didn't have time to go through today. So, but I've just tried to put together five statements that, or five meditations, they're only brief, that we can reflect on, that sort of address each of these aspects, each of these possible interpretations. And some of them are going to jump out to us more than others, right? Some of them are going to appeal, some of them are going to have more significance than others, and that's totally okay. I'm not in any way saying these are right. But let's just, maybe we could just put the lights down a little. I think it might be great if the band could come up, because we're going to go straight into communion afterwards. And, you know, I will introduce communion now, because we can go straight from this meditation into communication, into communion. We have gluten-free crackers and juice at the front and in the middle here. Please serve yourselves with one another, or take that and go back to your seat and drink alone. We have candles you can light at the back of the room, candles and prayers for Ukraine at the back corner there. And you can write out prayers under Grow and Journey. We're going to have a time of responsiveness, okay, where we can respond to God in the way that sees fit for us. But let's listen to one possible interpretation. Then I'll leave some silence and move on to the second one. My God, I hang here under the crushing weight of human fear, hatred, and violence. My body, heart, and mind are racked by the tragedy of separation from you and your love. My God, I am nailed here to the cusp of subjectivity and objectivity. I feel so abandoned by you, and I just cannot see through this darkness. And yet I know you are with me, Abba Father. I know I am your beloved child, and I will never let go, because you never let go of me. My God. My God, here I am, naked and alone, lifted up and exposed as a symbol of shame and the futility of resistance to power. But I choose your way of love, your paths of righteousness. You desire mercy, not sacrifice. And your love will overcome all fear. My God, my God. My broken body looks like judgment and failure, but it is a declaration of your love. May this word made flesh soften their hearts and open their eyes to their fear and isolation from you. May the love flowing from every nail, every thorn, every insult be a river of forgiveness and reconciliation. My God, you have asked me to walk this path. I was born to love. I set myself apart for sacrifice and service. I am not a victim, but choose my destiny and run gladly into your heart of infinite compassion. So let's stay in a prayerful, contemplative place. And when you're ready, if you're ready, come forward, take communion, or move around the room as you see fit. But just respond the way you feel you need to at the moment.